Welcome to the Look Far podcast, Voices from the Wild. Join Look Far Conservation as we talk to conservation leaders from around the world about their work, their life, the challenges they face, and the successes they've had.
Josep Del Hoyo is one of the world's most important birders because he wrote Birds of the World, but he came and visited here and he said he'd never been to a place where things were getting better. So that gave us a lot of hope.
All right, episode number 6 of the Look Far podcast. That went by fast. Alex, Nicholas Locke, I mean, I told you, right? He was just going to be the most amazing, optimistic, happy, inspiring person you could probably bump into on any given day.
You know, I've never heard anyone speak so enthusiastically about planting a tree, but listening to him talk about it, the progress that he's made over the years, was just so inspiring. Oftentimes when people are talking about, you know, conservation and the state of our planet, it's just so easy to think negatively. But Nicholas is just so refreshingly positive and just upbeat about the progress that he's seen in Regua. And after listening to him, it's hard to not have a similar mindset.
It's amazing when you go there, you drive around in this awesome blue pickup truck that they have that's on the Look Far website for those curious, lookfar.org. They have a photo of it there. And he starts talking about all the things you're doing, and you're realizing that no one told him to do this. There's no textbook he consulted. It was just Nicholas and his wife Raquel and his family and others there that have been helping them, looking around, finding stuff they thought was good to do, and then just doing it. And I love it. It's hard not to have that energy to be contagious.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard to leave a conversation with him and not feel inspired to go make difference in the world.
And we had a hard time ending this podcast too. This is a good, meaty, lengthy discussion, but well worth it, and a great prelude for anyone ever thinking of making their way down to the Atlantic Forest. Hopefully one of these days when some of the pandemic craziness subsides, and visiting Nicholas and Raquel at Regua and seeing what I think is just world-class ecological restoration. So should we give it a spin?
Yeah, let's get to it.
Okay, well, we are here with the incomparable Nicholas Locke. Nicholas, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott, and thank everybody for listening in. This is a wonderful opportunity to tell you a little bit about what we're doing in Southeast Brazil, this amazing conservation project that's now celebrating its 20th anniversary. It's great. Great to be here.
So it goes by the name REGUA, which is an acronym. You're probably far better at saying it than me. Nick, what does REGUA stand for?
It was an acronym that was developed from the word Guapiaçu, ecological reserve. And if you say that in Portuguese or in Spanish, you'll have the Reserva Ecológica de Guapiaçu. That's a bit of a mouthful. So we reduced it to the Reserva, RE, and the Ecológica, Reserva Ecológica, RE, and you have the Guapiaçu that was abbreviated to GUA. So that's Guapiaçu is the Tupi Guarani. It's the native tongue from the indigenous folk that lived here. And it just means big river, Guapiaçu. Guapi would be river and Açu is big. So that's like Rio Grande for your listeners.
And the Guapiaçu watershed, this is your area of operation. It's a couple hours drive from Rio, so quite accessible in many respects. Tell me about the Guapiaçu watershed. It's part of the Atlantic Forest, one of the most endangered ecosystems in the world. I think only about 7% of the original Atlantic Forest is still standing. But tell me about the watershed and what it's like there.
Okay. For those listeners who have never been to Rio de Janeiro lies in southeast Brazil on the Atlantic seaboard at the base of a chain of mountains, which is called the Serra do Mar, the mountains of the sea. And basically it's a huge escarpment, it's continental escarpment that was raised out of the sea, forming the South American continent. And basically, if we go back hundreds of millions of years ago, we would have had the supercontinents and they spread apart. And finally Africa, which Africa shaved off from South America roughly 160 million years ago, And we are left with this part where at the base of this forested gradient, which has more or less suffered virtually no climate change and no continental drift for all of this time, which has led to this amazing biodiversity. And so the Atlantic rainforest, which hugs the entire Atlantic seaboard, stretching from Rio Grande do Sul to Rio Grande do Norte, covering an area of about 1.5 million square kilometers. It was one of the most biodiverse regions, it still is one of the most biodiverse regions of the world. And Rio de Janeiro is more or less bang in the middle of it, if you look at it lengthwise. And Rio de Janeiro is that marvelous city with that huge Inselberg, which is that granite dome. And Regua is situated about 2 hours from Rio de Janeiro city on the backwaters, on the plain, on the continental plain. So it's, and it was very close to the sea, not less than about 10,000 years ago, when there was a higher sea level. So we are located in a very, this project Regua stems from my great-grandfather's property that was purchased back in 1907, and it had the backdrop of these most exquisite mountains. And of course, everyone who arrives and visits us is very impressed with the beauty of the place. And likewise, my great-grandfather had this project of developing a farm, really, in those days. And he went exploring these this lowlands to be able to create this farm. And basically, all the lowlands areas were explored, leaving all this gradient completely forested. Of course, they used to extract some timber in those days. So the Guapiaçu watershed is one of the watersheds at the backwaters of Rio de Janeiro, and it measures roughly 450 square kilometers. And it has, as the name says, it has the Guapiaçu River at its base. So all streams, we have a very high rainfall of about 2.5 meters of rain a year. We have a wonderful hot season, and it still gets quite hot in the winter as well. So it's hot and very hot, the two seasons, but it contributes to this magnificent biodiversity. And so what we do have are 20,000 different types of plants, for example, and we have a multitude of various other animals. And because this area was quite inhospitable back in the early centuries, it retained a lot of its forest. And so the Guapiaçu watershed actually retains, when you said 7% that's left, it actually retains 60% forest cover, which gives it a huge edge over in creating a conservation project and attending what are now today's great pressures, environmental pressures and interests.
Yeah. Absolutely. And when you look at the entirety of the Atlantic forest, that 7% that's left, or whatever the actual number is, something single digits, there are these clusters. There aren't that many. And you're in one of them where there's still a lot of forest left. But to me, what's been most profound, most inspiring, when you go to Regua and you see some of your famous before and after photos, where there was an old abandoned farm, badly degraded land. You came in and found a funder, made the purchase, planted a diverse number of different types of species of trees, you know, always very important, not just dumping some monoculture in there. And the way in which you have practiced ecological restoration, in my biased, limited, but somewhat informed view, is truly among the world's elite. And the way it's been defined, where you have this watershed and you can look at it on a map and you can see the parts that are still forested, you can see the parts that you've reforested, and you can see the parts that could still support profitably all kinds of people, and then still others that are candidates for reforestation that can further connect and fill in. And it's one of the most hopeful things to see. Because knowing how much you've done already, thinking about where you'll be in another 10 or 20 years is exciting to think about. And yeah, I look forward just to coming down and seeing it. But let's go back. So when you came on the scene, you've done a lot of restoration. And I think, I dare say, of all the people in the world who have been keeping track of how many trees they've planted, you've got to be in the top 10 of the world leaderboard. So take us back to when you got started. I think this was 20, 25 years ago, maybe longer. And you started really practicing sort of restoration in earnest. What was that like? What did you do? And then just how many trees have you planted so far, Nick?
Well, thank you for your compliments. That's very nice. We all like to be recognized, and it really is. It is wonderful. It keeps us our nose on the trail, as it were. We started planting. I've always been interested in trees. I was born in the UK and lived very close to Kew Gardens, and the English have a passion for trees. And living next to the Kew Gardens, you could go into the hothouses and see tropical forests. And we know from David Attenborough and countless other naturalists that the tropical ecosystems support a vast diversity of life. So when I came out here when I was 19 years old and came with to see what my great-grandfather had purchased in those days, I came across this same hothouse, but literally walking into a massive world of a hothouse. And it's something that it's so impressive to walk and see trees naturally growing, huge, massive trees growing and supporting life. Life that exists totally independent from us. And I think somehow that's a sort of magic that I was seeking when I was a young lad. You read a lot when you're a kid, and I read a lot, and I used to go a lot to art exhibitions, and the pictures of Henri Rousseau were so magical in the fact that you had this maiden sleeping in the middle of the forest with a lion just growling right next to her, and you're raised on these stories of adventures of these naturalists that traveled to these shores, and to find all of that really made a deep impression upon me. So much so that I started finding seeds of these big trees and as a pastime would put them in pots. And you have germplasm actually creating a new tree. And that gave me such a feeling of creativity within me that I wanted to do different types of trees. And slowly my life has been really mainly focused on farming when I was my professional career. And then I sidestepped into conservation, as you say, 25 years ago. And our donor arrived, a first donor who saw this place and saw the importance and the relevance and the potential here. He said to me, "Nicholas, what would you do over here if you had this vast, extensive lowland?" And he said, "Well, I'd love to make a botanical garden." He says, "Really? Would you reforest the whole thing?" I said, "Absolutely. That's what every young person wants to do." He says, "Well, I'll give you the money to buy the property, and you go ahead and do it." And do you know what? We started organizing the planting, and we worked out that we weren't going to do it all in one go because it was a bit too ambitious. And we planted, I think, 2,500 trees our first year in 2004. I thought I was going to have a heart attack. Because the trees required, when I saw them needing a bit of water, I'd go along with my watering can to try and water. But 2,500 trees is a vast number of trees to water. So then I realized judiciously that if you planted at the right time of the year, you'd be able to take advantage of all the summer rains. So instead of planting willy-nilly, you'd actually plant at the right time of the year, prepare your ground, and then you would plant just when the rains were about to come. And that would save you all that stress in terms of looking after these trees. And we did that very the second year was very successful. The third year we actually we obeyed the same law, but unfortunately the rains never came. So fortunately I had all these volunteers, and many of them are from your country, Scott, and they all came along, and they all, with their watering cans, we managed to give them the equivalent of a Pepsi can or a Coke can of water, and that was enough to pull them through for about 10 days. We do that regularly, and that was enough to pull them through the 10 days of drought. And today, that area is just a massive forest, which is the pride of what we do here. So together, over these years, we have planted about 650,000 trees, native trees, on roughly, it's reaching to 1,000 acres of woodland, and these forests are beginning to work as an ecosystem. So what do? We harvest seeds of the trees that we find in the forest. So this is local from the gene pool here. We work with about 200 to 250 species of trees, and these we propagate inside in our nursery. We have a team. We have a man who scales trees and cuts all the seeds. then work with them, clean them all up and prepare them. And then we put them into our nursery, into our sandboxes. And the sandboxes work very well because they're the best thing to germinate seedlings because they come out with a very, very clear root. From then, we actually transfer them into plugs or we transfer them into plastic bags. And then we work through with a various mesh for reducing sunlight so that they actually have a time to be able to adapt to their new conditions fresh out of the sandbox. And then when they're finally actually growing quite well within their new bags, we take them out into the full sun. We water them, of course, constantly. But the fact that they're in the sun gives them a chance to harden up, toughen up, ready for when we're going to take them to the field. And this process has been working very, very well. We have a forestry engineer who's just as passionate about trees as I am. She absolutely just wriggles in delight whenever she sees a new species giving fruit. And whenever we harvest some seeds, there's always a surprise because we have so many tree species in the Atlantic rainforest, but some of them are not really known. And the botanical gardens, for example, told us that there are about 500 tree species where they don't know, they know they exist in the Atlantic rainforest of real estate, but they don't know where. So we're always, every year we're finding a new species. In fact, we just found a new species for the real estate just last week, and we managed to gather about 500 or 600 seeds. So these will be planting within the new tree planting areas and then offering to friends as well so that we multiply them and people. And, you know, it's all about wrapping up a story about a tree, how important that tree is, what it benefits, what plays within the larger ecology. And people become excited. People realize they all have very exotic names. They're all basically all scientific names with Latin and Greek origins. And slowly we ravel a story around these trees, so much so they become our little heroes. And it becomes very exciting to watch them grow and see them actually fruit after maybe 7, 8, 10 years. And they actually fruit, and that's just a day of reckoning. It's just a day of delight. So planting trees, we think, is the second most important activity we do. The most important activity is actually securing land, but I'm sure you're going to ask me about that a bit later within this watershed. But the second most important activity is actually consolidating forest cover. So even though we have 60% forest cover in a 450 square kilometer watershed, we don't think that's enough. We really want to try and reach to what it looked like before the woods colonized this whole entire area. So creating wetlands and replanting some of the reed beds, planting forests and ensuring that they grow, and a diversity of species. So reaching back and planting tree species that you would normally not find on the lowlands. These are all things that we try and reach for in order to increase and improve resilience of the forest, filling up gaps, creating connectivity so that forest fragments are then reunited back to forest blocks. This is what we do, and we're doing this very successfully. So marvelous.
No, it's fantastic. So a number of little avenues I want to run down. The first is tree planting. So tree planting is actually, you make it sort of look and sound easy. Tree planting is really hard. And getting it right, and when you can plant 100 trees and a lot of attempts at reforestation, they'll see upwards of 70-80% die off and not make it. And if things go bad, and others might have, you know, much better percentages. You've been really successful at managing all the different risks, all the different variables that have to come into play just to have a successful planting. And then on top of that, the diversity, the sheer number of species of trees. And I loved, you just mentioned, you keep finding new ones too. And this is not an area that hasn't been studied. Every time I've been down there, you have multiple scientists running around picking through one thing or another. So to continue to find new species in spite of all that attention is really remarkable, really speaks to the biodiversity. And you know more about this than me, but as I understand it, you know, every tree's seed germinates in a different way. And so it's not enough just to gather the seeds of 100 different trees and scatter them around on the ground. You have to get them to germinate. I mean, each seed has its own sort of way in which it will cooperate and germinate. So how do you grapple with all those, you know, variables, and what's your sort of success rate been in terms of when you plant, how many trees make it and how many don't?
Okay, that's a lovely question. Thank you for asking that. I'd love to tell your audience that I think trees are very easy to propagate. And nature is very clever. What she does is she makes the rarest trees the easiest to propagate. And she makes the easiest trees the hardest to propagate. Isn't that interesting? So the pioneer tree species are actually the hardest to propagate. And nature helps us by making the climax tree species large angiosperms, big seeds that normally require the gut of the tapir to be able to go through. They make those seeds relatively easy to propagate because they're large and you can put them in one bag and basically they'll follow up. We have actually very complex forests. And if you like, and you can study generally how forests come back by their own natural regeneration, you notice that it's the pioneers that come first. They create a shade, and all the leaves that are growing that fall down, because of course we are very high in fungi as well, and fungi are constantly attacking all the trees and the leaves. And the trees, they don't want to lose out on photosynthesis. So the moment their leaf become inefficient, the tree discards that leaf, and that leaf forms the millions of leaves. Of course, start forming mulch, and that mulch is under shade, is the motor of the forest. So if you're able to imitate that through your judicious practice of tree planting, so you plant a mixture of maybe 40 to 50%, let's say, of pioneer trees. And if you can look after your climax tree species in the beginning, you will find that you get your diverse forest growing very quickly and forming that canopy to start off the process of the forming of mulch and the decomposition of leaves. And when you get that decomposition, because trees are always living off the, we now know that the fungi in the soil is the one that most important, because they actually bond onto the seedlings and also the tree roots. And it's the fungi that are actually working in capturing the elements. So nitrogen and phosphorus, it's all these fungi that are doing this. And what they get in compensation are all the sugars from the tree. So there's this very nice exchange. And of course, there's underneath all of the forest ground, so on the soil, there are all this network of tree roots all communicating with each other through the fungi. So there's a very interesting community underneath the mulch. And so having this mulch is what you want to aim for. You want to get that mulch formed. And the mulch comes from obviously having your fast-growing trees in order to create a forest cover. And the forest cover then will then reduce the sunlight and offer more humid conditions on the soil. And then you get your whole thing growing. The whole forest ecology will just take off. I mean, the whole thing is like giving sugar to children, really.
That's great. That's great. Well, I know a little bit about that. So I stand corrected. Tree planting, not so difficult. But what about land purchase? So what about buying land in Rio de Janeiro State in Brazil? I know that we could probably talk for days about this, but when you have an opportunity to acquire a parcel of land, tell me about, you know, sort of how those opportunities arise. You know, you live in the community, you're a longstanding member of the community and in good standing, you're able to develop relationships with people. So it's hardly this sort of helicoptering in, spraying cash around and then putting people to work. This is very much just an extension of what you do. But even so, though, land purchases are always complicated, or at least maybe not. Maybe you'll tell me that's easy, too. But tell me about when you go to acquire a piece of land, what's that like? What are some of the tricky parts? And what's been your approach to doing that at a very local level and in a way that's been sustainable and mutually beneficial for everybody?
Okay, that's a very interesting and good question. So it's also core to Regua's activities since 2003, when we purchased our first property from one of the family members who was deeply sympathetic to the idea of creating an ecological reserve here out of the family estate. So we actually acquired two or three properties quite easily And I could imagine that in any place, the first two or three will be easier, and then gradually they become harder because landowners, they would like to get a little bit more for their land. And if they see somebody acquiring all the land around them, they cotton on pretty quick and they wonder, what's the motive? Why are they buying all this land? And the only way to combat that is for those people to raise their prices up and hope to get a little bit more. So that's understandable from their point of view. Of course, we're talking about a concept which is today, in the year 2021, deeply interesting and important for the entire planet, which is conservation. And we have many friends who work in conservation. And it's a common idea is that land purchase is one of the best ways to be able to secure and govern land. Can you make parks? Yes, you can make parks. But fundamentally, parks tend to be a little bit dependent on government officials. You never really compensate landowners. So you're not sorting a problem. You're creating a different problem. Whereas land purchase, no, is very effective because basically you determine, you govern what is going to happen with that piece of land. We've always been extremely transparent with our ambition, our vision, and our modus operandi of the way of working. We aspire to make one large contiguous forest cover that is fully protected for the future of Rio State. We have to remember that Rio State is the same size as Costa Rica. So Rio's state is pretty large. We're also very lucky, and I think I didn't answer in the first question of yours, that we are located in what is Rio de Janeiro's largest remaining Atlantic rainforest fragment. It's over 100,000 hectares, so over 250,000 acres, and it's very large, and there's no organization that's working. It's all either some form of government land or a government park. That's how it's made up. And we know that government is limited with its capacity to outreach and include and change things. And really, if we think about it a little bit more, the government is a representation of its society. It's us. So there's no reason why we can't actually help the government in reaching to some of the greater and the grander ambitions. And today, we see that conservation is very, very important. So in Brazil, it's very interesting. For most of the country, is privately owned. So land purchase is actually not an difficult thing to do because all land is privately owned and has its own title. And we have been also around here for the last 120 years or so. Not me personally, of course, otherwise I'd be a bit like Methuselah, but certainly we are known and we know everybody around for countless decades. So of course, when this whole project started, it wasn't that difficult to identify because we already knew the landowners around, we already formed a community. And we knew who owned what. And of course, then with the objective of trying to preserve biodiversity, we knew which properties to secure first. We secured two or three very large properties, but we've also secured many, many very small properties, which are equally important within this whole composition of properties that lend themselves to this contiguous conservation. And over the years, we've been remarkably successful. So far, touch wood, really, really good. This process has been really, really successful because what do? We identify who owns what. If we know that person is interested in selling, we go along in a very friendly and casual manner and ask him if he would be interested in selling his property, if it's on the market. If not, maybe a land agent might advise us that some property that is within the watershed is for sale. Have you thought about buying that? And we go along and start establishing contact. And a lot of it really depends on very close and easy conversation. This is not for Nicholas. This is about ourselves, about humanity working and living within its environment. And I think that is today, that is an overriding argument. It's very persuasive in allowing people to sell their properties to the organization to increase biodiversity for biodiversity's sake. And I think more and more people are seduced by this. I think they're more encouraged to do this in a constructive manner so that has favored our growth. And as an organization, having the greater amount of land is very important because management costs will reduce as you have a larger area. And what we think in the future, because this Guapiaçu River is so important for a number of cities in the state, the water is harnessed for drinking water for almost 2.5 million people, We think that in the near future, there will be eco-service payments which will help towards the financial sustainability of the project. So we think not only are we protecting biodiversity, we're addressing a very contemporary issue, which is that of conservation of natural resources. We actually are reaching out to those landowners who have preserved their forest and who would prefer that RAGWA actually bought their piece of land if they want to sell, of course. They could always be partners with us, which is obviously very preferable. And we have been able to gain enormous kudos from becoming large because it means that you're invited to all the weddings in the valley because you've become the largest landowner, which is, has its drawbacks as well. But
Well, and the depth of your impact locally. I mean, you're well known, but for only good things. The state government's taken notice, and you'll have to refresh my memory, but I think last time we talked, you mentioned that the government officials were visiting you, wanting to learn about how you're doing restoration and wanting to try and take what they can from your example to do it elsewhere, that your reputation now precedes you, and that RAGWA within the watershed and within Rio de Janeiro State, within the Atlantic Forest, this has become kind of a center of excellence and is appreciated far and wide.
Thank you. Yes, that is very much the case. And one has to be very careful when one reaches that position, because it's not a question of us trying to influence politicians or decision makers or stakeholders. It's really trying to coax them into following by model, by our example. And we are totally transparent about what we do. We're totally pure with our objectives. And I think that purity is what allows people to come to us. And we also, as a result of that, we do courses and we're trying to reach to the younger society, introduce them into what the importance of what we're doing, learning from what we're doing. And we have demonstration units of the universities here are all having the trial plot so they can actually measure some of the growth of these trees and measuring runoff, water retention, how these ecological services that we talk about. It's very important, and I stress this with all other projects that I meet, is that it's absolutely essential that you create a good channel of dialogue with local government. They are so important because they are the governing body of any municipality or any territory. And by earning their respect, it gives you a free road to be able to move on. And that is very important because in this part of the country, people still are a little antagonistic about conservation. Their ancestors, when they opened up the country, many of them suffered in this process of opening up the country. It was a very hard life. And they see that conservation is something which could be questioned from that perspective. Of course, we know now that a protected landscape is one that provides eco-services in abundance. And of course, we realize that that is much more important than having open land and having a few heads of cattle. But still, we have to work very carefully and tenderly with our local community in ensuring that we are not disrespecting and just trampling on their own wishes. And that is something which we also have been very good at. I must say, we have a very good team. There are various tools that you can use. It's all about inclusions, what we call social inclusion, bringing people in for them to understand what you're doing, to be very open and talk very sincerely and honestly about them. And of course, employing as many local people as possible. That is absolutely essential.
Yeah. And I'm really intrigued by the emerging opportunities for payment for ecosystem services. And this idea that the more of the landscape you restore, the more its value in terms of assuring ready supplies of fresh water, enhancing resilience in the wake of storms, droughts, floods, you name it, starts to become really interesting and creates a current and I think a future revenue stream that can only further support and sustain this kind of commitment that you've made to restoration. I know another revenue stream, though, is tourism, ecotourism. I am not a great birder by any stretch, but I feel like I got a lot better just by spending a few days in RAGWA and borrowing someone's binoculars. You attract a lot of attention and a lot of visits, at least in normal times, not pandemic times, but with birders. So two questions for you is, you know, tell me about the ecotourism aspects of it and how you've kind of sought to approach that and develop that. And then, you know, how has it been this past year? And how have you tried to kind of navigate these challenges?
It's very interesting how this project started with an ambition that was clear in a framework that we wanted to work within protection, education, restoration, and research. And we needed to try and find some sort of sustainable activity. We just didn't want to be a dead weight for our trustees so that yearly we're expecting some sort of payment. We are trying to reach towards a sustainable model, which is almost inexistent as well, Scott. We have great difficulty in finding conservation projects that are actually profitable. And could you imagine even have shares on the stock market? It doesn't exist. So, I mean, of course, you have in Africa some wonderful, and you have in your country some fantastic parks, but they tend to be subsidized by the government, even with the impressive numbers of visitors that go there. The maintenance costs are very high. So since the very beginning, perhaps it comes from my farming background, I've always been interested in trying to use this in a very friendly, benevolent manner, non-intrusive manner, to be able to make it profitable. And one of the avenues we searched for right in the beginning was tourism. And tourism is fantastic. It's a great opportunity. We offered, certainly, it centered around bird observation. So people would come here typically to see as many birds within a shorter time as possible. And we trained a couple of local hunters who were really brilliant birders, the bird guides. They got eagle eyes, actually. And they knew where all the birds were. So people could walk. It's very hard to walk on this gradient. It's not that easy, up and down, and it's very warm. But saying that, by offering a comfortable lodge, nice cuisine, a nice hot shower, and even the early starts with a breakfast, and even with a little van that would take you within about 2 hours radius, within 1 week, 5 days, you could see 300 bird species. And this became very interesting for the bird community, because the birdwatching community has blossomed since year 2000. And a lot of companies from Europe, from the US and from Canada, South Africa, they're all taking people all over around the world. And basically, if you're going to see birds, you're looking at the very best remaining habitats, because birds will always be present in these habitats. So there is a sort of like a correlation between bird watching and visiting very well protected reserves. So we got into the market because we're very close to Rio. It doesn't mean it's not too strenuous. It's an international hub so that you could get a flight from Europe and the States, wherever, and you could land in Rio, and within 2 hours you were at the lodge and listening to owls and the night calls, night of the forest here. And so what we did was we created a wetland, and this wetland, most people were draining land, and we decided to go and do the opposite thing, was making this gigantic pond. It was about 40 acres or so. And this attracted a huge array of wetland species that you couldn't see anywhere else because the wetlands didn't exist anywhere else. And of course, they're associated with the Atlantic rainforest. And this also became a huge attraction. So people could typically see some of the lowland species of birds, some of the aquatic species of birds. Then you could go in the van and we would take people to the top of the mountains, where there would be almost, I wouldn't say the Arctic conditions, of course, because the temperature drops 1 degree as you climb every 100 meters, but it'd still be very cool. And I did get accused of hypothermia by one group of people, which was most alarming. But anyway, so... And you could go and see some of these rare species that are associated with the higher altitudes. And birders, we had an added attraction. We were restoring habitat. Normally, bird lodges are located bang in the center of endemism or forests, and you have to take canoes to get there or something like that. And this area here was actually pretty poor, but it was reforesting, and we were getting constant news of new species that were occupying those new forests. And that became a very much an exciting kudo to explore. And also people started realizing that why not go to Rego? They're actually seeing more birds than they did 15 years ago, which is actually the case. So we even have Josep Del Hoyo, who's one of the world's most important birders because he wrote The Birds of the World. But he came and visited here and he said he'd never been to a place where things were getting better. So that gave us a lot of hope that we were on the right path. And sustainability, coming back to sustainability, there's not tourism equated to about half, if not more, of 60% of annual income from tourism, which was amazing. And you did mention the pandemic, of course, that has completely floored that, but it has given us a chance to work on some of the other projects that we work with. So Regwa, because it works in education, because it works in tree planting, because it works in research, is receiving funding from other sources that that make for the funding that, that maintain the core staff and maintain the project actually growing. So it's really good to have various fruit in the basket. And reaching to sustainable income, we are looking at water provision services, so these eco-service payments. We're looking at carbon carbon credits. We're looking at of course, we're looking at tourism. And tourism not only restrained to foreigners, is actually growing within Brazil. People are starting to wake up to the fact that what they have is very, very precious. And people come from very, very far to see this. And that gives them they say, well, what do they see that we can't? And it's when that question starts is that they start coming with binoculars, they're coming with cameras, and they're starting to take a great interest in what we're doing. And it all it's a great narrative about important species. All the species that make up, if you can tell a good story around, wrap a great story around it, it becomes of great interest to everybody at all ages, which is marvelous. Gives us hope for the future.
It's remarkable to me how well your experience shows that if you invest in nature, it creates so many different potential revenue streams. Tourism, payment system services, carbon, community engagement, scientific research. And it gives you this highly diversified, fairly robust, you know, local economy that in good times and bad has got to compare awfully favorably to cutting everything down, trying to raise a couple of cows and make some cheese that you might be able to sell at a, you know, rock bottom price on some local exchange, that you know, you can do well when you do right by nature. And I think that Regula's example is really powerful in that regard. Mindful of our time, it's always the one real bummer about this pandemic is that I can't go and do all these interviews in person with everybody, but because we could sit and talk for days and days. Let me ask you briefly about your own history and your family's history. You alluded to it a little bit earlier, but I find it remarkable that you're not new to the area and in fact have a family connection more than a century old. That's not all that common in the conservation realm, that these lands have been in your family for a long time. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that and then what drew you from England back to Brazil and what induced you to stay?
Another good question. My great-grandfather came from Germany. He went to Buenos Aires. He was escaping the Prussian wars in Europe. His mother sent all the boys out. They all did very well in South America. I think there was obviously a lack of local industry, so anyone investing in industry and used to what existed in Europe and then applied it to South America did very well. And my great-grandfather was sent by his brothers, he was the youngest, by his elder brother, he was sent to Brazil, to Rio, to be able to set up a silk factory. This is back in 1900. He did incredibly well. He visited this area, fell in love with it. And curiously, it's actually mentioned in a geologist, an English geologist by the name of John Moore, back in 1807, who visited the same area. And he actually describes this because it's an old convent for the Carmelites. And so my great-grandfather fell in love with the place and developed it, had a succession of administrators. His three children were all girls, and all three received a third share of the farm. And the one who didn't marry, fortunately, left it to my father, who my father was an architect in London. He had moved to London because he'd actually graduated in architecture in London and couldn't find work in Brazil, so we all set up in London again. And basically, I remember a very short period of my infancy with my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, who was a Dutch guy who would go around in a blue Jeep, no different from the Willis war Jeeps that you have in the General Patton you see in the war films. And he was this flamboyant figure with white hair, red as a tomato, as you can imagine, from Antwerp or somewhere like that. And he would he just loved it out here. He was a bank man. He was the regional bank director for the Dutch bank. And I remember this man taking me in his Jeep to when I was about 3 or 4 years old. That's when we lived here, when my father graduated trying to get a job in architecture. And I remember drinking my very first Coca-Cola, and almost dying of overdose of excitement and having a Coca-Cola and a piece of bread and company with my grandfather. We would drive all over the place in this open top Jeep. And then when I came out in, we went back to England as a family, never saw my grandfather again, which was very, very sad for me. And so there was this yearning to come back to Brazil. Not that I was driven by this Coca-Cola and the white and the bread, but it was just this excitement of living, really, living hair drawn back with the wind and the warmth of Brazil and the freedom of life and being able to do what you want. And so that drew me back when I was 19. I wasn't going anywhere with my studies, far too interested in art and literature. And so when I arrived here, I did a course with my apprenticeship with my uncle, who had received a third section of this farm, of this large farm. And I just fell in love with this place. And I thought, wow, this is all the adrenaline I could possibly need in my life. These are more endomorphins packed into one person than ever. And it was just seeing these forests, being able to dive into a crystal clear river and just seeing the beauty of the magic of nature. And this really, I had to go back and I went back and did a technical course in farm management and came back as fast as my legs would carry me. And one of the things that marked me most was this fact that I saw that my Dutch grandfather had been planting trees back in the 1940s. And in the late 70s, I could see those trees were huge. So that gave me a very early message saying that I only had to wait 40 years and those trees would be large, of gigantic proportions. And so I started playing around with seeds. And as I was telling you earlier, germinating them and seeing that they would grow, and started planting them. And you know what? 40 years later, I have seen all those trees I planted. They're just massive trees. So what am I saying? There is a sentimental attachment. There's a sort of spiritual attachment into a connectivity with my great-grandfather, my grandfather, through being here. And I think that inflames me with passion. That inflames my wanting to do things. And now you're raised in the developing world, and one is very constrained. And so having this liberty here, this freedom to do whatever you want, is something which you really have to value. It. You have given one chance and one little straw you've picked to be able to follow your life course as you want. And really, that is very exciting. And I've given a lot back in terms of thank you so much for providing life. Thank you so much for providing me with that opportunity. So that's the way I see that I can give something back through, of course, having this foot in either continent or having this. And I very soon realized it was in my agricultural course that to be successful is all about communication. So if you can communicate, you can reach to anybody from pauper to king. You can reach that person. You have a common ground. And I found those tools that I gained from my college were instantly applicable within not only farming, but in creating conservation reserves, in reducing conflicts, in trying to secure land for an ulterior motive. And I found all those, this tool of being able to communicate and reach to people and plead people to join the force, I find that I had that and I could use it very effectively. It's very sincere, by the way. It's not an act.
No, I agree. I mean, I was just thinking how listening to you, there's nothing more energizing than being in the company of someone doing what he wants to do more than he wants to do pretty much anything else. And hearing about the decisions you made and the progress you've had, always inspiring and energizing. And I can't wait to get back down there. I think that's the fifth or sixth time I've said that. So, I'll probably end up looking at airfare by the time we're done recording. But we should transition now to the three questions we ask everyone at the end as a way to kind of wind down and to create a common endpoint. So question number one, what gives you hope?
What gives me hope? Two things. One is that if you plant, we're very much conditioned to planting trees. It's what we really enjoy doing. But what gives me hope is I am not a pessimist. I'm not a pessimist at all. I'm an optimist. And it gives me hope that we can fix things, that we, through our creativity, through man's creativity, if you remember, Leonardo da Vinci had this marvelous figure of a man fully extended within the circle, and he dominates that whole entire space. We are very creative as people, And we're absolutely bound to nature. We, even though we use it sometimes badly, sometimes very badly, but sometimes in a very good way. So what gives me hope is that we can fix things. We can offer the hope for the future for mankind. And I think that if we can reconcile our demands within a planned territory, which is all protected and working with respect to nature, it gives me hope that we all have a future and that our grandchildren and our descendants will have a life that will maybe even better than today's, maybe even better than what we're expecting today. So I know I can measure that by, I see that trees react favorably. I can see that through the camera traps that more and more life comes to areas that are forested. And I see that even weather patterns, local weather patterns are less harsh when you have more forest. So these three measurements, these three metrics, trees growing, weather patterns, and more animals shows me that nature can come back with our care. And it gives me hope that we can care for the planet and we can see children and we can see people being inspired by this. And I think that gives me a lot of hope.
Regula gives me hope. Just hearing that. Question number two. If you could look ahead 10 years, what's something specific? And I know there's probably a lot, but name one thing that you would like to see.
To be very honest, I would like to see a group of people here taking this on and just coming along and giving some, guiding some people for some of the talking a bit about the past history. But I think if I look at 10 years, and probably the most honest thing I would like to have is that it's a clear idea of succession, that this has been successful, and that there's a whole group of young people here who are as ambitious and as passionate as I am and inspired to be able to move this on even further. I think there's potential, I think there's interest, and I can see that actually we create a solid, well-greased model. The success of this will engage with other people. I think I can see it working. And that will give me immense satisfaction.
And the last question is, how can people help?
How can people help? Well, I want to say that how can REGWA help everybody? And really, it's about this story, which is so exciting. I always tell the students that come, we talked about sustainability. We do a lot of courses for students because it's such a wonderful place to sit and listen in those classrooms and things like that. What I tell those kids is that they could be, each of them could be a doctor in terms of in speciality, not to listen just to the cell phone and the common media and just be interested in the neighbors and things like that and in music. It's actually to take an interest in the natural world. And there's so much material out there, so much information. Each of them could be a specialist in whatever species they want. The life of nature is just pulsating out there. And if each of them could actually become a specialist of their own, they would all help give nature a greater value. So if listeners can just get engaged in whatever way, and in a local way, they don't have to come and help us. They can, I mean, I really would like to see a REGWA and hundreds of thousands of REGWAs around the planet. Because all it is a group of people who are responsible for a rather large area. And I think that if the listeners want to help, it's by getting engaged with their own preservation groups, with their own small NGOs, and get active. It's not about money. It's not about money. It's all about attitude. And if we can actually get engaged and show younger people that it's so exciting to find out how a pond works, how the ecology of a flower works, what the life cycle of certain animals and how they're interrelated. This is so exciting. It doesn't need to be the most important subject, of course, but it is so exciting, and it's where young people can learn from, is this passion. Younger people will be inspired to carry that on from their parents and their friends. So if listeners want to help, get engaged. The world is out there in every single way. Everything's beautiful out there. It's a perfect world. It's a perfect world. There's no mistakes.
It's fantastic, Nicholas. And for those interested, you can find REGWA online, REGWA.org, and REGUA.org. You're also on the LookFAR website, because we've done some work together, and I hope to do more. And beyond that, on our partners page, also one of my very, very first trips for LookFAR, we were in REGWA. and got to drive around in that great blue truck that if it ever goes missing, you'll know who snuck onto your property and stole it. And it's parked on off the road somewhere. We were checking out, I think, one of your reforestation efforts. And I just turned around and just very randomly snapped a photo that to me just represents, you know, in the field, doing work, seeing great things. And I love being able to ride around the watershed, sitting in the back there with whoever else you've tossed in, you know, into the back of the truck, and getting to see, you know, this incredible landscape and to see how it's changed and to see what else there is to do. So it's an exciting, inspiring place. So regawa.org for those who are interested. And Nicholas, what can I say? I really appreciate this. This was awesome. And I hope we can do it again at some point down the line, but when we're in person.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Absolutely. Wonderful. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. You're a sound person too. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful opportunity. Thank you very much, Scott.
LookFar is a US 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to defending wild and wondrous places and working with the people living in and among them. More at lookfar.org.